Hi, I'm Piper.
And I'm Erin.
Welcome to Off the Tracks podcast, where we explore what it means to do law differently.
Today we are joined by Joshua Lennon, the lawyer in residence at Clio, an intuitive cloud-based legal practice management solution. And we are so excited to have him here.
So Joshua, we are so excited you are here closing our Off the Track season with us today. We always love to start by really getting to know our guests in their own words. And we'd love if you could tell us a little bit about how your career has evolved over time.
Thank you. It's great to be a guest on Off the Tracks. I'm very excited to be here. If I have to describe myself, it's actually hard to do. It's always that tough question. Most people know me by my role, which is lawyer in residence at Clio, which is a completely made up job title that is actually now starting to pick off. There are four or five lawyers or attorneys in residence on LinkedIn if you search for us now. And all the job really means is that I translate the needs of lawyers and law firms to a tech company, and vice versa. I translate what a tech company means to lawyers and law firms and how they can all work together. But how did I get there? I think is the really interesting question. I am a Gen X lawyer. So I'm at the tail end of Gen X. And like a lot of Gen X people, I was casting around trying to figure out like, what is my career going to be? And I'd always been interested in policy. Like I knew that there were basically two sets of laws that govern everything we do. There's the law of physics, right? You can't go faster than the speed of light, for example. And that has always held me back. But then there's the law of policy, which is something that is constructed. And we make a lot of choices when we think about policy, whether we realize it or not as a society. And I wanted to kind of know the inner workings of those choices for both kind of academic reasons, but also I think personal, like how can I leverage policy in my favor? And that of course led me to law school, like any good English major. And I graduated from law school just immediately before the Great Recession. I was really lucky. I quickly amassed as many hours as I could in law school and got out a semester early. I got out with a lot of experience under my belt because I took externships as a part of getting those hours. And I even studied abroad, earning a certificate in international and comparative law and European Union law on top of that. And all of which left me completely and utterly unprepared for the next choice that I made, which was I ended up following my significant other to Canada, where she was working on her PhD. And one of the things they don't teach you in law school is how little a JD travels. It just is not something that translates well all around the world or even around the United States. What we see for most graduates is they tend to be employed in the city or metropolitan area where they graduate, unless you're some of those elite top law schools that are basically recruiting tracks for a couple other major metropolitan areas. Right. And so I was one of those cast off graduates who turns out had to make up everything from scratch. So with nothing but a JD and a deposit on Barbary to sit for the bar, I signed up for the New York bar, only to be told by Barbary that they don't support the February New York bar. They especially don't support it when you're abroad in Canada. So you're on your own and no refunds. So I had to teach myself the New York bar, sat for it in February. It turns out that's the most depressing time of the year to take a bar exam, not just because of it being the weather and it being Buffalo, New York, but also it turns out that the New York bar is one of the most difficult bars in the nation with a very high failure rate. And so a lot of the test takers in February are actually the people from the summer who had failed and are taking their second bite at the apple. So a little fresh-faced lawyer, Joshua, is sitting with really despondent and depressed people taking this bar exam and just trying to keep my energy up. But I passed. I passed on the first try. And I leveraged that into opening my own law firm in upstate New York, focusing on immigration law. And I did that because I was actually spending a lot of time crossing back and forth on the border and actually being hit up by a lot of people in our academic friend circle on how do I get to the States to study. So I was like, okay, business opportunity. I got to do something. So I'm going to do it. So I did a day job with Thomson Reuters, editing their manuals. They happen to have or had an office in upstate New York a long time ago, and running this immigration law firm on the side. And I leveraged a couple of new and innovative tools that actually changed my life. This is like the big ah moment. And the first of those tools was this little microblogging service called Twitter. Read about it in the New York Times. I've always been a fan of blogging, but I always feel like it's an overcommitment to write like 400 to 600 words every day. But I can do, at the time, like 120 characters. So I picked up Twitter very early on. I was one of the early adopters on Twitter. And the other piece of software that I turned to that changed my life was software that I was using to manage my little immigration practice. And that was a piece of software called Clio. And I picked it because it was cloud-based. And that meant that I could access it on my laptop in upstate New York. But also when I was in Toronto visiting my significant other, I could hop on her laptop and access my law firm at the same time. And it made it to where I could be in two places at once. Which was something I was doing all through the week. I would work 9 to 5 at Thomson Reuters, editing tax manuals, thrill of my life. Then I would work the evenings on my immigration law firm. And then come Friday, I would hop in the car, drive a little over 200 miles around the Great Lakes to go visit my significant other in Toronto, spend the weekend there, get up at 5 in the morning on Monday and drive the reverse back to upstate New York where I would start the tax manuals all over again. And it was not an easy time, but the things that I was doing on Twitter, which was kind of my water cooler, get to know other lawyers, do some business development, actually started gaining attention from people who were interested in reforming legal education, people who were also learning the practice of law or struggling with the practice of law, or people who were learning how to use new social media as a business development technique. And I rapidly gained this a really interesting network of people from thought leaders like Richard Susskind, the author of The End of Lawyers and Tomorrow's Lawyers, all the way down to this little software company that I was using to manage my law firm, Clio. And Twitter became a conversation point between myself and this software, Clio. I was able to get support via Twitter and ask questions. I was able to make suggestions and getting those incorporated into Clio. I was able to refer other people who were looking for help with their law firm and how to manage it to this company, Clio, as well. And so those conversations actually then began to transcend Twitter. And we started meeting in real life when the American Bar Association held their semi-annual convention in Toronto. I was there and ended up meeting Clio and a couple of the early employees who were manning a booth there. And we got to know each other and have coffee and beer and create a relationship. And that led to them actually flying me out to Vancouver, Canada for a day of consulting that ended with them asking the question that changed my life, which is, do you want to join us? And at the end of 2012, I said, yes, I'm going to come and work for this company. So I ended up shutting down my law firm, going into this weird quasi in-house role. And I want to stress, I'm not Clio's in-house counsel, but becoming the voice for an industry to a vendor to that industry. And my career has been that focus ever since. So the short version is, Twitter got me my job. The long version is the ups and downs of the legal industry and the economy that it's tied to, as well as my own weird choices about moving around internationally, have led to my role at Clio as lawyer in residence.
I love that story. And I think it's so interesting that just over a decade later, I have a very similar story to yours following my fiance out to do his PhD, using Clio to work remotely from Halifax, Nova Scotia, while having all my clients in Ontario, and using Clio as the tool to sort of get there. And then also using Twitter. Piper and I were quite active on Twitter at the beginning of the pandemic, and sort of how the idea for the podcast blossomed and how I got my firm off the ground. So it's just so interesting to see the similarities between our stories. And I'm so thankful that you did, and that you are the lawyer in residence at Clio, because they have such a great presence online, and I've absolutely loved it. And it's just so funny to hear you talk about, you know, oh, it was great, I could give input and they would incorporate it. And those are still, you know, a decade later, the things that I love about Clio as well. So
yeah, the things that I valued about it. Sorry, I stepped on your
toes. No, it's okay. Go ahead. Yeah. Go for it.
One of my goals at Clio is to keep that value, right? The things that I valued when I was practicing and using Clio to manage my law firm, I want that same utility to the people that we're supporting now. So I'm really actually glad to hear that that's coming across, because that's one of the things we work very hard to maintain.
Yeah. And I think it's great, because obviously the company has grown a lot, but that is one of the things that remains the same. So can you tell us a bit more about how Clio has evolved over time? Because you've now been with them for just over 10 years. So what has changed? What's evolved?
Yeah, so I'll lapse into startup speak now. And so startups go through these series of funding, venture capital funds. And when I joined Clio, they had just gone through their Series B, their second round of funding. And so that meant that they were able to move from like the temporary rent your office for a day location that they were in to a sublet from IBM with all of IBM's cast off cubicle furniture. That was when I joined. And they had about 40 some odd employees. We've since gone through series C, D, and E. Each one of those brings in more money, bigger investors, but also some pretty significant demands on the company and in terms of how you perform. But we've grown from the little 40 employee scrappy team that I joined to now where I think we're just over 1,000 employees. We maintain offices in Vancouver, Calgary, and Toronto, Canada, as well as Los Angeles, California, and Los Angeles, California, Dublin, Ireland, and we just opened one in Sydney, in Australia. And so we've gone global. We've gone from, you know, maybe like 1,000 law firms who were really dedicated early adopters, to now helping over 180,000 different law firms in over 120 countries around the world, if I'm getting that number right. So we have lawyers in all the continents around the world, except for Antarctica, and I'm working on it. And we continue to support the growth of different law firm models on top of that. And so one of the things that I think is really interesting about Clio is we've gone from being kind of the tool that only solo and small firms knew about to now actually reflecting the greater legal industry. And so in most jurisdictions, the majority of lawyers are solos. So you'll see like 50 to 65% solos, depending on the state or the province you're in. And then the rest of it is small law firms, medium-sized law firms, and then those few at the top, the big law. And Clio has grown now to encompass that entire range of lawyers. So we have that huge influx of solos that we help and support on a daily basis. But we also have made inroads into big law. There are big law practice groups that are now relying on Clio every day across multiple offices around. See that uptake? But also, it becomes really sobering when you know how many different cases that Clio is now supporting and how many clients that Clio is now helping lawyers for whom they are responsible, right? And so this type of work isn't like working at a lot of other technology startups where you're providing a service and if it goes down for like a day, that's not a big deal. In Clio, we really have to view the work that we do as mission critical. Because for somebody, somewhere, every minute of every day, it is. So we've grown a lot, but in growing, we've only seen like an increase in responsibility and a need to be prepared for the next level challenge each time.
Okay, so I'm really going to out myself here, but Joshua, we don't know each other that well. I know we were so lucky to get you on the podcast today because you know Aaron. But so I no longer practice law. I previously practiced law. And so I don't claim to be in and up to date with all of, you know, the hot legal tech. I do still work in the legal profession, but in a non-practicing role. And for me, Clio is like Kleenex. You know, like Clio is like Kleenex. Like Kleenex is, you know, a facial tissue or whatever you want to call it. But to me, Clio is like, oh yeah, you're talking about practice management software. Obviously you're talking about Clio. I genuinely don't think, and maybe this is just my lack of my only year and a slightly over a year and a half of practice, but like, I genuinely don't think I can name another legal practice management, like cloud-based software. If I tried. And so I think that that's just so interesting as you talk about the growth. When I think about practice management software, I only think of Clio.
That's really nice to me, like personally, that's personally gratifying. But yeah, there are competitors out there and some of whom are nipping hot at our heels. Clio was the first, I think, to realize that there was now this distribution channel for professional grade software to help the solo and small lawyer. And prior to that, you had like your Thomson Reuters and your Lexis who sold really expensive software that you had to invest both a lot of money in the software itself, but also a lot of money in the implementation of that software, the hardware that went behind that software, the maintenance of that software. It was all like this huge ongoing capital expense and tens of thousands of dollars in outlay before you even got to like log in. And Clio recognized way back in 2008 that nobody was really servicing the majority of the lawyer law firm market because they just were too small to handle that initial capital outlay. And so they used the cloud and the internet to give people enterprise grade software, but at the SaaS software as a service type price and model. So it was pretty innovative at the time. But since then, we've had a lot of copycats who are now out there. And some of them have really good ideas. Some of them are literal clones of Clio. But there's still a lot of room for growth in this marketplace. And so I cannot say that Clio is the only one out there. I can say that we're the biggest. And I know that we personally try really hard to be the best.
So earlier you clarified for everyone that you're not in-house counsel at Clio.
Yeah.
Or the lawyer in residence. And so can you talk a little bit more about, you know, what the difference between those roles would be at a place like Clio or more in general and what your role encompasses today? Because obviously it's evolved, but sort of right now, what does that mean?
I tend to work on a team by team basis on how I support the organization. So the things that our corporate counsel does is helps the business organization handle its business legal needs. So leases, employment contracts, board updates and maintenance of our cap table, which is the stock that we have like awarded people as both employees and as shareholders. Those are the types of things that our corporate counsel will do on a day-to-day basis. They're also in charge of our vendor contracts and making sure that as an organization, we have full insight into our legal obligations, as well as the legal obligations that we as a business are relying upon from others. Then everything else kind of is left to the lawyer in residence. Left is probably not the right word there because we very much are a team. But when it comes to things like, is our product compliant with the needs of our customer base at a global level? Those are things that I will turn to and work with our product team as a product counsel, investigating issues of data and privacy security, investigating issues of reportability. Are we providing the exact reports that are going to be needed in this jurisdiction for this software to be compliant? I'll work with our teams on making sure that we understand the difference between confidentiality and privacy and cybersecurity, which are all three different things that kind of work together, but can have very different meanings. And making sure that we incorporate that 0.01% of legal workflow that is different than business workflow. An example I'll give is trust accounting. So all small and medium-sized businesses have an accounting need, right? Whether it's a mom and pop store or an e-commerce place, you need accounting. But lawyers also need trust accounting. And trust accounting is weird because it's completely backwards from normal accounting. If I walk into any mom and pop store and just give them $20 with no expectation of getting anything right now, that mom and pop store now has a $20 asset. They're $20 richer. You go up to a lawyer and give them $20. They're now $20 poorer. They owe you $20. And that's where trust accounting is weird and backwards and has all these extra reporting requirements around it. And it's sprung up in the legal industry to protect clients because a lot of lawyers are bad with money. It's not something that our corporate counsel gives input on. Not because that team and the people who lead it aren't adequate. It's just not their responsibility to keep up to date with the changes in trust accounting rules, like what's happening in California right now, and making sure that we're internalizing that as a product and passing that on to our customers. So that's a compliance role that I do. I also work with our support team as one of the ultimate escalation agents, because oftentimes lawyers will, when under a lot of stress, react poorly to customer support. And one of the things that we talk about is how much stress lawyers are under, right? The fact that something's not working the way you need it to is a really big deal because time constraints are huge in the practice of law. But that doesn't mean you get to be rude. And it doesn't mean that you can ask for things that are non-compliant with either the way the software can operate or as your jurisdiction requires. And so I'm one of the escalation agents who can be brought in to review these types of questions and scenarios and work directly with our customers to let them know that there is a lawyer on the other side of the email or the phone call who is taking their suggestion seriously, but also providing the type of analysis that'll help work through the problem as they need it. Again, that translating lawyers to a tech company role. I'll also work with our marketing team and provide subject matter expertise on a whole variety of things. We just launched a bar reciprocity hub where I was the one who went through 53 different jurisdictions admission rule sets and compiled who is or is not allowed to transfer between those various jurisdictions. So if you are a California lawyer, where can you go? But if you want to go to California, who is allowed to go there? Those are two completely different questions and different sets of rules. And how do you convey those in an easy to search format? That's one of the ways I work with our marketing team to provide that. And one of the big projects I work on year round is Clio's Legal Trends Report. And I don't know if either of you are familiar with it, but it is an annual report we've been putting out since 2016, where one of the kind of really interesting, unique things about Clio is because we're both cloud-based and really widely adopted, we have unique insight into how lawyers are actually practicing law in a way that nobody else does. And this is the part where I always have to like caution. We cannot see lawyers' case files. We can't see their communications. We have both technical and contractual constraints on that. But what we can see is usage data in Clio, and some of that usage data might be the hourly rate that's been set. I can't tell you which law firm sets which hourly rate, but when I have them all together in the anonymized aggregate format that we do, I can see the bell curve of which hourly rate is most common, which hourly rates kind of like the extremes and the highs and lows. And we can even break that down by geography and practice area. And so Clio's Legal Trends Report is able to publish things like the average hourly rate for lawyers and non-lawyers across North America. What's been the ridiculous growth in both matters created and revenue gained over the last 4 years. And then we also do our own additional research into topics like business development and marketing for lawyers. One of my favorite of those was we did a secret shopper experiment where we took the five most common practice areas in Clio. So that's criminal defense, family law, civil litigation, real estate transactions, and then corporate business law, oftentimes for small and medium-sized business. And we had a secret shopper organization go out and randomly identify 1,000 different law firms who did one of those practice areas. And I wrote 5 different prospective client queries for each of those practice areas. We just sent them out to see what lawyers would do. And I'll just give you the spoiler alert. 600 of them never even responded to us. 400 did, but a good chunk of them responded to the email inquiry from the website that said, email us. Most of them said, hey, can you call us instead? And then they never answered their phone. Out of the thousands that we contacted, only 2 actually got back to us in what surveys have told us is a good time frame within a business day, with a clear, friendly answer that addressed the limited number of questions that we put in there and gave some type of pricing information. That was it. That was all we were looking for. And out of 1,000, only 2 came back to us. So the Legal Trends Report is where we really dive deep into a data-driven insight into the practice of law. And what's interesting to me is these are all the questions that I was asking in like 2010, like what price should I charge, right? How many hours a week is like a good week? Like I feel like I'm working a lot, but I'm not billing a lot. Is that good or bad? What's going on here? And the Legal Trends Report can now start to give you some insight into what the average law firm actually does and our best guesses into how to take these lessons and apply them to your own law firm to improve the things that you want to improve. That's a lot of the stuff that I do.
Yeah, just a few things that you do. I think that's crazy. The whole list of the reciprocity and everything between the states. I can imagine that was a huge project to take on. And of course, I love the Legal Trends Report because it's great. I can go on and see, you know, exactly what you were talking about. It's been a super huge comfort to me as I started my practice and continue to, I guess, for coming up on almost 3 years now. So it's been a great help. But you have got so much insight into the, you know, legal practice and, you know, especially across multiple jurisdictions, you know, across countries, now globally. Mm-hmm. What is one thing that you wish you could change about the legal profession?
I think there are 2 things. One's external and one's internal. So the 2 things I would want to change about the legal profession is, the first of which is that it's much harder to be a lawyer than it should be. So it's a hard job. It will never be an easy job. But I think a lot of the systemic failings in the legal system get piled on lawyers to carry and fix. So things like underfunded and unresponsive courts, right, are left to lawyers to handhold their clients through. And that's an extra burden on the lawyer because we don't have a modern responsive judiciary like we should everywhere. And so things like that just make it harder for a lawyer to be a lawyer. And I would love to find some way to like clear up some of the systemic access to justice barriers that we rely upon lawyers to just deal with every day. You're talking about the fact that you help clients in Ontario. Like Ontario is one of the horror stories for court filings, right? Because even now, after the pandemic, they still have trouble with e-filing, and they never had it before. right? And so if you wanted documents from the Ontario court, some clerk had to go to their document repository and physically pull the paper as long ago as like 2020, and probably still today, depending on the case. And that's the type of barrier that the courts are just perfectly fine saying, you know what, that's the way the system is, and lawyers, you have to deal with it on behalf of your clients. Like, and even pro se people have to deal with that as well. But fortunately, we see that judges tend to take a little bit of more professional independent judgment when it comes to pro se litigants than lawyers. And so lawyers just have to shoulder that burden. The second thing that I want to fix for lawyers, and that is something that I think I can contribute to at Clio, is breaking down the silos between all of the lawyers. If the majority of lawyers out there are solo practitioners, that means that they're losing out on opportunities for collegiality, for knowledge sharing, for client referral and business development sharing in ways that I think Clio can help. And so one of the things I'm excited for is we have an online forum that we call the Lawyer Community, where we're starting to publish templates, community submitted templates. And so if you're a family law lawyer in a jurisdiction, you can look and find templates of documents that might apply to your case. And we're enabling that kind of connection and knowledge sharing in a way that just didn't exist before. So just like the Legal Trends Report is data driven, I think we can now build a community driven process to improving the practice of law and make it easier to leverage those community insights in the tools that you use, like Clio. So if a lawyer is providing a template, we can easily and hopefully seamlessly bring that into your Clio account so you can use it. Or we can start helping with better client referrals. So if you, Aaron, do the intake, but it's for somebody else, right? You're like, this is my client, but I don't handle this type of work. Maybe I can hand it off to Piper. We can make it to where you can do a share between Clio accounts, such that Piper gets the information that she needs to help that client without you losing that visibility. And the idea of allowing Clio as a whole to operate as what I see as the biggest law firm in the world is kind of my end goal. And if we can make that possible, then the productivity enhancements that come from technology, the amazing leaps forward that we can generate via community knowledge management can be leveraged by everybody, lawyer and client alike. So I got my work cut out for me, but that's what I want to change.
I think the potential within the intersections of tech and law, as we've already seen so far with things like Clio and others doing other types of work, are just so profound. And, you know, the legal profession is, sometimes it's very stuck in its ways. And so it's great to see places like Clio doing such great innovative work and pushing change forward. And so I can't wait to see, you know, what you continue to do in this role and beyond. But Joshua, we're so curious because you left us a note when we were doing some prep for this episode. We're very curious to hear what you like to do when you're not at work, because you left us a note about sand volleyball, and I would love to know what this all entails.
So this goes back to my undergraduate days where I played volleyball obsessively. So I was on the college like volleyball team. I am not a tall person. I am a very average sized person. So it is not the sport that you would associate with me, but I very much enjoy it. For some reason, I just see the math, the geometry of volleyball. It just clicks in my brain. So I joined that team and I played with that. And then we also had sand courts on the campus. And so there would be a handful of us playing all day, every day throughout my undergrad. And that's carried over now to where I live in Vancouver. And we're really lucky we have actual beaches as opposed to Missouri, where I went to undergrad. And so I can continue to play sand volleyball here. So the beaches at Spanish Banks, as well as some man-made beaches where they have teams. I do both pickup and collegiate games here, where I continue to just get dirty and dusty and roll on the sand. And it's something that I really enjoy doing. It's one of those things where I think you can kind of work out those negative feelings, right? To where you can really just toss the ball up and hit it as hard as you can. And that's where those negative feelings go. But at the same time, you're with friends, you're out in the sun. There's a teamwork aspect to it that I very much enjoy. And even if you win or lose, everybody's shaking hands and high-fiving under the net so that you walk away happy. And that's what I like about that type of experience.
That is so fun. And I think it's always great to have something that you're passionate about outside of law, especially, you know, in your role, you have so much going on. It's nice to have something that, you know, like you said, you can sort of get out of your mind and get into your body, so to speak. So thanks so much for speaking with us today. This has been such a joy. And we like to end all of our podcasts with the same question, which is, what is something new that you've learned recently?
Ooh, I've been spending a lot of time, I think just like everybody in the tech space right now, taking a look at large language models and trying to understand their implications when it comes to the practice of law. What I think is fascinating about them is that I think we're not there yet, but we're going to be at an inflection point to where we really can start to take the client experience of trying to transfer this huge body of knowledge over to their lawyer. And we're going to be able to take that transfer and automate it to a huge degree. So that when you say you're getting a divorce from your spouse, right? One of the things that needs to happen there is a financial disclosure where we have to disclose all of this information. And normally that happens with a huge stack of papers being dropped off, hopefully wrapped in a rubber band, maybe organized by a client at your office. And now what we can do is really say, okay, we're going to take these group of documents, we're going to put them into this analysis tool, and it's going to extract all that data for us such that we can then start to look at both strategy, how are we going to handle this divorce, and desired outcomes. What do you really want from this divorce? Rather than focusing on, hey, I'm missing that tax return from like 1997. We really need that. And what was online 40C? That's important, but it's going to be less effort in the future. And so that's what I'm learning right now is how are we looking at this data transformation that large language models can do in the practice of law?
Okay, Joshua, that's so neat. And not to put you on the spot, but I'm obviously about to subsequently put you on the spot. We always have guests, right, fill out a bit of a pre-episode form beforehand. And we always encourage guests to, you know, stray from their answers. But I will say that the answer that you put in the form about what you learned recently was very cool. And I'm going to peer pressure you to share it. I will preface it. It was about Saskatchewan. Do you remember what you wrote in?
Oh,
this yeah. is wild to me.
So my day to day is varied, to say the least. And so, you know, I will work on a really technical issue relating to the transfer of data from one field to another. And then I might work on things like AI. And then I'll jump into compliance questions. And this was a compliance question. And we were looking at the rules for professional conduct in the as published by the Law Society of Saskatchewan. I don't want to put them on the spot. This is merely a statement of fact as the rules exist right now. And if you have a trust account in Saskatchewan, you are not allowed to do electronic transfer withdrawals out of that trust account unless the amounts are $25 million Canadian or higher. And that just boggles the mind that you can't do like an electronic transfer of funds out of your trust account for anything else, right? Like a real estate deal or a refund to the client. If you want to do those withdrawals, it has to be via paper check for anything less than $25 million. And even with $25 million, you have to get approval by the executive director of the Law Society. So it's a really interesting set of rules and posing a really interesting compliance challenge to software tools like Clio. That's why we're reviewing it. But it was obviously done to make sure that there was a well-documented trail of trust fund withdrawals. And it speaks to the protection of clients that the Law Society wants to do. But man, it must be a pain for some of the lawyers that work there.
Damn, no kidding. Okay, thank you for sharing that, because I had read that when you wrote in and my mind was boggled, and I don't even deal. I've never had my own trust account. So even as someone who's never managed a trust account, I was like, this is bananas. Joshua, thank you so much for being here and for sharing your insights with us today. It is such a joy to get to connect with you and to hear about all of the knowledge that not only you've like gleaned from your career, but that you've developed. I feel like you've, you know, developed all of this new knowledge in your field, and like, we're just so lucky that you're here sharing it with us and that you share it online. We're going to link all of the ways to follow along with you on Twitter and LinkedIn and all the things in the episode notes, but thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you. Yeah. It's a lot of stuff that I have learned from other lawyers. And so I'm really happy to share it forward.
Amazing. Thanks so much. Thanks for listening to this episode. This concludes season 3 of Off the Tracks. To stay up to date with the podcast, follow us on Instagram at Off the Tracks Podcast. Stay tuned for what's coming next, and we hope you have a great summer.